Please be seated. The story of Elijah and Elisha is an epic story. It is pure Hollywood mixed together, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Indiana Jones. And this would give just some of the ingredients. There are wicked kings and queens, wild bearded ascetic revolutionaries. That's Elijah. Wide-eyed acolyte disciples eager to drink from the deep well of the master's wisdom. That's Elisha. Sacred, powerful garment. That's Elijah's cloak. Incredible scenery, mountains, deserts, huge rushing rivers. And we have not even considered the special effects. And what special effects they are. Spielberg and Lucas would be so proud. Whirlwinds, rivers magically parted, firestorms beyond our pyrotechnical dreams, deep, booming, cavernous thunderstorms, deafening roars, sparks, spectacle, energy. Fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry. Oh, wait, those aren't from Elijah's story. They're from Paul's letter to the Galatians. And what a letter it is. Here's that list again. I don't know about you, but I always cringe when I hear it in church. Fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealous, anger, quarrels, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these. Whatever those Galatians were up to, it certainly was not stamp collecting. And what themes Paul raises. The dangers of replacing slavery of one kind with slavery of another. Slavery to self-gratification and self-indulgence. Let's look at this in detail. What a vivid description of Elijah. The whirlwinds, the fire, rather like the disciples in the Samaritan village. They must have been thinking about Elijah as well. They asked Jesus if he wants them to summon down fire on the Samaritan village because the town folk didn't receive him. What an extraordinary episode. What on earth were those disciples thinking, wishing a fiery destruction of that village? Foxes have their holes, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Let the dead bury their own dead. But weren't we talking about the Galatians? We seem to have been distracted by Elijah. Or was it the Samaritan village? And that is precisely the point. There are so many wonderful, exciting, vibrant, insightful, diverting, important things that could be said about all of the readings today. We pass so easily from one to the other, settling on the little vignette that takes our fancy, and then another. And what we end up with is a glorious technicolor mess. In this day and age, distractions abound like mushrooms in a dark, damp basement. Far from avoiding them, we appear to seek them out. The term multitasking doesn't seem to have negative connotations. In fact, if we tend to view the ability of to do more than one thing at a time as a virtue, texting during a meeting? Sure. Why not? Checking Facebook at a dinner party? Why, yes. Doesn't everyone? We want the people around us to think that we have full, busy, important lives and persuade ourselves as well. We dart from one shiny thing to another, wowed by things that are sleeker, faster, bigger, higher. And that also is precisely the point. There are so many distractions, diversions. But each of these unite us to take our minds off the ball. Faced with a bewildering array of choices, we easily become unfocused. We lose our single-mindedness. All of the characters that we meet in today's readings, apart from Jesus, are distracted by something. The disciples of Jesus are distracted by their mistrust of the Samaritans. The people that Jesus and the disciples meet on the way are distracted by their material possessions, duties, and social conventions. The Galatians are distracted by all manner of transitory, selfish gratifications or petty jealousies. Elisha is distracted by the thought that he might not inherit Elijah's special powers. Even Elijah has been distracted. Much earlier in this story, he had challenged the pagan prophets of Baal to a competition atop Mount Carmel to see which of their respective deities was the more powerful. And in that special effects extravaganza, the pagan gods were crushed. The triumphant Elijah orders the massacre of all 450 of the prophets of Baal. After all of this spilt blood, Elijah falls into a deep depression and hides in a cave. No doubt there were reasons for his dejection and his hiding, since there was probably a price on his head. But there was more to it than that. "Enough, O Lord," Elijah says, "take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." Remarkably, this is nothing less than Elijah's conversion. He had set his God Yahweh in competition with the gods of Baal. But all Elijah had achieved by this was to put himself on the same level as the pagan prophets he'd claimed to despise. The contest on Mount Carmel had merely ended up being a show of strength between rival leaders. Elijah has spent his life seeking God in the earthquakes, the wind, and the fire, but had eventually found him in the still, small voice. In his book, Faith Beyond Resentment, Roman Catholic theologian James Allison calls Elijah's dark night of the soul his undeceiving. His realization that what set his God apart from all others was not that he was more muscular and whose religion was more efficacious, but that God was in fact the very antithesis of all of this. Elijah's conversion experience seems not to have filtered down to Jesus' disciples. They, along with the rest of their contemporaries, seem to prefer Elijah in his noisy showman phase. When Jesus' disciples suggest raining down fiery destruction on the Samaritan village, their understanding of God is just as off target as Elijah's had been. Time and again we are shown how the disciples just don't seem to get it. We know that eventually they do, but it's a long journey for them to realize that God's strength is in weakness. God's rule is in servanthood. God's power is in humility. And God's judgment is in forgiveness. And before we congratulate ourselves on being smarter and more insightful than those first disciples, let's just take a moment to consider if we ourselves and the church in general get it any better than they did. More and more people are saying that the church is at a pivotal point in its life. Some even describe it as a collapse. Certainly, it is a time of wholesale reassessment. But maybe that's not such a bad thing. Perhaps, as Christian commentators like Diana Butler Bass and Phyllis Tickle suggest, it is that we are on the brink of a new great awakening. Perhaps it is where we will hear afresh the still small voice of God and what God's voice is inviting us to do, and where we will understand much better how to break free of the slavery of our distractions.